Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We already covered the part one of the New York ratification debates. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to give you a sample where Hamilton likes using language that exacerbates or tries to create drama when he's referring or answering or giving a retort or response to somebody's argument that, hey, this, you know, this is a real problem. And so what he does is it's condescending for him to kind of come along and say, oh, this is a phantom. So what I want to do is I want to show you how he did that in the Federalist Papers as well, so that we can just do kind of a real quick comparison. And and the other thing I want to actually show, because I'm going to do it as soon as I'm done with my obligatories, I'm going to show you some of Hamilton's more powerful and I think more succinct comments in the Federalist Papers in contrast to his comments and how he articulated his arguments in the ratification debates. You know, here's one of the smartest guys next to Madison in all of the Republic. And why is it that he was so mealy-mouthed and so soft during the ratification debates? I pose to you the challenge of why he used such strong and very succinct and direct language in the Federalist Papers, where he kind of danced around and played politics more, or I should say the legal dancing he played in the ratification debates really speaks to the character of the man. Because here is a lawyer who understands the legalities of, you know, being under testimony and providing testimony to the delegates at the ratification debates, in contrast to writing editorialized letters and, or if you want to call it propaganda, because bottom line, there's no legal binding ties to the Federalist Papers. They're insightful. Yes, you can learn some insights from them, but they are not legally binding like the ratification debates. The ratification debates was a legal process of accepting the compact called the Constitution. And so when testimony was being provided by the delegates who went to the convention to say, this is how we discussed this, this is how we came this, you know, this phrase to be, and this is why, and this is what this means. All of these clarifications coming from these Federalists in this testimony is legally binding. The Anti-Federalist testimony is not legally binding because their testimony was rejected. And what do I mean by that? During the ratification debates, if your state ratified, they acquiesced to the Constitution, they legally and formally accepted it, then that means that they bought into, they accepted the clarifications, the terms, the definitions provided by the Federalists, and therefore rejected the hyperbole and the nonsense that the Anti-Federalists were purporting or trying to assert during their portion of the debates. So, understanding that every state ratified, there was really no formal rejection. It just, some states took longer than others, but all 13 states basically affirmed and acquiesced on the Constitution by formally ratifying it. So anyway, here's the obligatories. This show is also sponsored by republicreview.org, and you do know that this is the only show that goes through these types of little nuances and details. I may not be, you know, the best professor or educator or articulate or entertainer, but I will throw the data at you. I will give you all of the facts, and I will let you make the decisions. Don't take my word for it. This is why I am giving you the framers' words. This is why I am giving you the definitions and the clarifications that the framers provided during the ratification debates. There is no greater set of documents in understanding the Constitution and what it really means. There's a reason why these documents have been buried for centuries, and I literally mean that. It wasn't until 1976 where the University of Wisconsin made the decision to try to document the ratification history. And as a very progressive school or educational, you know, university, I mean, these guys were Marxists. And as they started going through it, I think they started really, because this was big publicity. This was, you know, real patriotism that these guys were putting out there. But you have to understand that the Marxists were in our university higher education, and even at that point in time, even in primary education in America, in the 1970s, many of my high school teachers and even junior high teachers and even elementary teachers were already, whether they knew it or not, were already promoting collectivism and communism. And so, whether they knew it or not, that's what they were promoting and providing and guiding all of us. Go listen to G. Edward Griffin's interview that I did with him a few years back. I believe back in those days, I actually documented what this podcast means. So if you go into my archives, you'll probably find where, hey, here's my interview with G. Edward Griffin. Go listen to what he said. I think he graduated in the 30s or the 40s. Probably the 40s, because I think he's as old as my father, or if my father was still alive, pretty close to the same age. And so if you listen to him, he will tell you that he was being taught as a collectivist and a communist in the education system. And so what we have is we've had a, you know, over a century of maturing the process and slowly filtering the water to getting all of what the communists would call the impurities. The impurities, in other words, getting the Bible out of the education system. See, they couldn't do this automatically. They couldn't start going against God and the Bible until the Bible was completely eradicated and those people who had any semblance of education of the Bible, they had to get out of school. So it took time. It was just kind of like, it took Moses 40 years to change the culture of Israel to be able to actually go and occupy the land of Israel before they were able to go enter into the promised land. Now, I'm telling you that it took the communists well over a century from the 1890s in America, because that's when they penetrated, late 1880s, they penetrated our education system and started teaching this stuff. And, you know, this stuff has been around. This information has been around for a very, very long time. And there's a lot of, conservative evangelicals out there that are talking about the education system and so forth. But not one of them, some of them are talking about homeschooling and so forth, but not one of them really has the full cure. As a matter of fact, I don't want to mention names at this point, but there is a person that's considered a subject matter expert on education and so forth that does not care about really fixing the problem, because this person understands that fixing the problem actually kills the goose that lays the golden egg, or at least is tightly associated to the organization that supports the goose laying this golden egg. Because bottom line, you will not join their group if the problem goes away. These people lose their jobs. They get unemployed. So when you talk to somebody that actually makes income off of the problem, ask them, you know, what is your interest in getting involved in educating people about the problem when it seems like you're making money off of this? If the real solution came along that we could get rid of, just like that, we could get rid of the government encroachments and usurping powers. If we could get rid of that, would you support it? And oh, you'd get the lip service to the nth degree. But then you point them to Republic Review, and they will turn their back on you. they'll say, oh, well, I don't understand that. I'll have to get somebody that can tell me what this all means, and I'll have to get back. And they will never get back to you, because the same subject matter expert told me that they would get back to me, and they never did. And as a matter of fact, I drew my line with that person a little while back, and I said, look, because he wanted to reprint one of my articles. And I said, if you want to reprint my article, you have to include that line down there that points to Republic Review. And they came back and said, and this is the interesting thing, this was like 6 months after they had received all the documentation. And after they'd received all the documentation, they came back to me and says, you know, I've read all of this stuff, and I understand everything that you sent me. And I've got it out to other people that are smarter than me to help me decipher some of this stuff. But 6 months later, they say, well, I don't know what this means, and because I don't understand it. And I'm going, holy, you told me you did. See, that's what I have to deal with all the time. These people are slick. It's all about money to them. I'm not out here trying to make a living. I am not dependent on doing what I am doing to put food on our table or put a roof over our head. The Lord has blessed me to get to this point and to this capacity. I do know that as I continue to do these things, I continue to get blessed. You want to get involved? You want to get blessed? Get involved in the cure. Get involved in the process. Get involved with Republic Review. And I'm going to guarantee you, the Lord will start manifesting blessings into your life, and you'll just be, oh my, you know, we don't have these problems anymore. These things kind of went away. Anyway, but I guarantee you, you'll have new problems and other problems. We'll be right back after these two promos. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we're kind of doing these obligatories, let me just also remind you that we have our comment line, 425-270-5416. Questions? You want to get involved? Believe you me, if you call, because I've actually had people call from the Trevor Lawton article and so forth, and people have found that number on our website, and I'll call you back. So worry not. As a matter of fact, email would probably be the easiest way. But anyway, either way, I will try to call you back, because if you send me an email, then I know I'm going to respond and you'll get it eventually. But if you call, sometimes I'll have to leave a message and we won't be able to connect, because 9 times out of 10, I don't try to leave long messages.
and you call and you say, hey, how do I get involved? That ends up becoming a long message, which usually becomes a conversation. But in an email, I can be a little bit more, you know, fully or verbose and be able to provide you the full, you know, data you need or what have you. But 9 times out of 10, it would help if you called and you said, hey, I live in Kansas, and how can I get involved with Republic Review and, you know, working to attack our state legislators, getting them on board and so forth? What groups or what have you that I can either work with or get involved with? And from that point, we will be able to, you know, I will start pointing you, because then I know where you're at. But if I don't know where you're at, then I can't identify who would be the best for you to work with. Anywho, let me move on to scrutinizing Mr. Hamilton. And so Mr. Hamilton, in what we just read yesterday, he's used the word phantom to try to marginalize the argument against this particular layout of government, aristocracy, and so forth. And so what he did is, this is what he said: this reminds me of a description of the aristocrats I have seen in a late publication styled The Federal Farmer. The author reckons in the aristocracy all governors of states, members of Congress, chief magistrates, and all officers of the militia. This description, I presume to say, is ridiculous. The image is a phantom. Does the new government render such a rich man more eligible than a poor one? No. It requires no such qualification. It is bottomed on the broad and equal principle of your state constitution. And so he uses the word phantom, or he uses this type of language to be very condescending. Again, this guy's a smart guy. As a matter of fact, he was considered one of the most literate people of his time. The only person I thought which actually rivaled him and was far more literate was Madison. And that was really more due to Jefferson. Because while Jefferson was in France and in Europe, every time Jefferson, I mean, he went out of his way buying all these different books. He created a library that ended up becoming the Library of Congress after the British burned down the Library of Congress, because him and Adams had more books than the Library of Congress. Anyway, so this is what Hamilton uses the word phantom in the Federalist Papers, and this is Federalist number 81. And he says this: it may in the last place be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is in reality a phantom. Particular misconstructions and contraventions of the will of the legislature may now and then happen, but they can never be so extensive as to mount to an inconvenience or any sensible degree to affect the order of the political system. Are you kidding me? Look at today and the bench. Why do you think Biden is trying to stack the bench? Because he recognizes the force that the court has in the minds of America. Everybody believes, hey, if the Supreme Court has said so, then that's it. Since when? The states are the final arbiters always, and you know this, because we go through this all the time. Anyway, he goes on and says, this may be inferred with the certainty from the general nature of the judicial power, from the objects to which it relates, from the manner in which it is exercised, from its comparative weakness, and from its total incapacity to support its usurpations by force. Well, see, he never gave them any credit, and he downplayed the intellectual side. Who would be worthy adversaries to challenge them? Understanding that the average person in politics at the time and moving forward may be lawyers, but they wouldn't be the accomplished lawyers. The accomplished lawyers would be the jurists. Not that we don't have accomplished lawyers in politics, or I should say corrupt lawyers. 9 times out of 10, I very rarely find a lawyer worth their salt, because they've completely bought into the perverted constitution and case law precedents and all of these things that are unconstitutional. lawyers are one of our greatest problems. And the bench is nothing but lawyers. And this is why the bench has been the I'll just say, the most effective tool in perverting and moving this republic in the wrong direction and antithetical to the Constitution. I mean, they've constantly supported the best way to say this is they constantly supported unconstitutional government, period, because they've constantly gone down this path. Oh, yeah, like homosexual marriage. That's a right now. There's no allowance in the Constitution regarding marriage. Federal government has no jurisdiction over marriage whatsoever. But now they came through this side door of saying, well, these people are being denied some rights. No, the federal government has no rights. You've got to understand that the federal government has been delegated very specific powers, and the Bill of Rights is only regarding very specific restrictions in addition to the few delegated powers. Show me in there where there's anything where the federal government has a responsibility of protecting the rights of the married. It doesn't. As a matter of fact, this is why the Bill of Rights was additional declaratory restrictions placed on the federal government. In other words, those things in the Bill of Rights don't create a portal for them to act. They are chains to bind them from acting at all in those things, like religion and so forth. Anyway, here's a couple of examples where Hamilton is far more concise. I want to read these now so that as we go through the New York the ratification debates of New York, you'll find that most of the comments that I do have are Hamilton's, but none of them are nearly as succinct and or powerfully placed or put as he has done in the Federalist Papers. You go, well, why is that? I mean, anybody that has deductive reasoning can figure out, well, obviously, his lawyer mind has worked to a point where he knows he has to be very careful with what he is saying under oath when he's providing testimony during the ratification debate. So those are legally binding definitions. He'll be held to that. That's why he danced around a lot. And that's why the New York ratification debates, they're milquetoast, they're decent. The one thing that they provide is they do not provide any contrary facts, like the concept of implied powers. The argument of implied powers occurred well after the ratification debates by Hamilton. And the reason that implied powers never really came up in the ratification debates is because the powers were delegated. They were specific. They were enumerated. There were no such things as implied powers. And it was stipulated as such throughout the ratification debates. So now Hamilton starts buttering the bread on the other side so that he can have the advantages that he wants to create in moving the government in the direction that he believes is a better direction. And so, you know, here I am taking a lot of time to point out the sins of Hamilton, because Hamilton was no friend of liberty. Hamilton believed, for the most part, that the government needed more powers. He was in support of a monarch instead of having, you know, a president that was limited to 4 years per term. Anyway, so here's one of his comments from the Federalist Papers. This is Federalist Paper number 26. Independent of parties in the national legislature itself, as often as the period of discussion arrived, the state legislatures, who will always be not only vigilant but suspicious and jealous guardians of the rights of the citizens against encroachments from the federal government, will constantly have their attention awake to the conduct of the national rulers and will be ready enough, if anything improper appears, to sound the alarm to the people and not only be the voice, but if necessary, the arm of their discontent. In other words, taking action. And this is a Federalist Paper. There's nowhere where you find that kind of language from Hamilton in the ratification debates, at least not that concise, not that well articulated. He gets into far more, I'll just say, theoretical things. Another one in Federalist Paper number 31, Hamilton says this: as in republics, strength is always on the side of the people, and as there are weighty reasons to induce a belief that the state governments will commonly possess most influence over them, there is a greater probability of encroachments by the members of the federal head than by the by the federal head upon the members. The safest course to lay them altogether aside and to confine our attention wholly to the nature and extent of the powers as they are delineated in the Constitution. So, I mean, he's right there to the point because he's not under oath. Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get back to the ratification debates. I actually have a couple of more citations, but I think it's really good for me to kind of read and kind of go through the ratification debates here and then providing, you know, a contrast of how Hamilton may have said something or the way he asserted himself in the ratification debates versus the Federalist Papers. And so this is why I think there's lots of conservatives and even so progressive constitutionalists like Obama and others love the post-constitutional Hamilton, because Hamilton was doing everything he could to stretch the Constitution and the general government, as granting them more power as he possibly could. And the arguments he laid out there, this is why he's cited so much by those left supposed constitutionalists. Again, I use the word supposed because if you're not going based on the definitions of the ratification debates and you're going on the words and opinions post the ratification of the Constitution, then those are just editorialized opinions. Unless they're based on and it's academic or academically tied to these definitions provided in the ratification debates, then it's just drivel. it's just worthless language. It's these people's opinions. This is why we need to have a definitized constitution of what everything in the Constitution means. We've got all this data in the ratification debates. We can clearly go through each part of the Constitution and be very clear, like Article 1, Section 8, the enumerated powers. We're going to get into this right now because Mr. Williams, Honorable Mr. Williams, he's probably a judge, comes out and he starts pointing out some of the language, but doesn't understand the language of Section 8 because, well, he points to the preamble of the Constitution talking about general welfare. Then he points to the preamble of Section 8, and then he points to the Necessary and Proper Clause at the end of Section 8 and says, look, it seems to me like we're granting these general powers. Here's the thing. I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to tell you that there was not a good Federalist clarification regarding this. There wasn't anything contrary from the Federalists in the New York ratification debates. It says, you're absolutely right. The General Welfare and Defense Clause is general powers that we are granting, and you're absolutely right to have this suspicion. No, there's no argument like that whatsoever. Nothing is laid out to even agree with this person. They just don't defend against it. Only in Virginia, North Carolina, and some of the other ratification debates is it very clear that that is a preamble, and the whole point of the preamble was to kind of create a tone or a tenor of, you know, the types of powers and why they're being given these powers, because they have the preamble and then they clearly enumerate the powers delegated. Everything in that preamble is just in a general speak. It is not specific, nor is it a general power. The enumerated powers delineate. And Madison was very clear. We will get into this in the Virginia ratification debates. He was very, very clear that why would we create a preamble or grant general powers and then go through the trouble of enumerating specified powers? Ah, because that becomes a contradictory. Because bottom line, the general powers was in essence a tone, as Madison said. You know, the whole point of general welfare is to ensure that the federal government was to ensure that all of the republic would have a uniform level of support. Welfare. Not, you know, a handing out of a check or, you know, stepping in because of a natural disaster. That's not an enumerated power. And then they go through the enumerated powers that Congress will have the power to do this, 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 this. Anyway. So this is interesting, and this is why I want to read this so that you understand how here's a person that is coming out with a very well-articulated argument about the three applications of clauses, two being the general welfare and then the necessary and proper clause, and saying, how are these not a general power? Anyway, this is what he says. In the preamble, the intent of the Constitution, again, this is Mr. Wilson, and this is on Thursday, June 26. In the preamble, the intent of the Constitution, among other things, is declared to be, quote, to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare, close quote. And in the clause under consideration, which is Section 8 of Article 1, the power is in express words given to Congress to provide for the common defense and general welfare, and in the last paragraph of the same section, there is an express authority to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for the carrying into execution this power. It is therefore evident that the legislature under this Constitution may pass any law which they may think proper. Well, actually, no. Remember, there are enumerated powers. They're very specific. There's no general power being granted. It is true the ninth section constrains their power with respect to certain objects, but these restrictions are very limited. So in other words, he sees these the preambles, but he doesn't recognize the separation between the preamble setting a tone and then the listing of the powers. And so, but these restrictions are very limited, some of them improper, some unimportant, and others not easily understood. Sir, Congress have authority to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, and to pass all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying this power into execution. And what limitation, if any, is set to the exercise of this power by the Constitution? Sir, to detail the particulars comprehended in the general terms taxes, duties, imposts, and excises would take up more time than would be proper at present. Indeed, it would be a task far beyond my ability and to which no one can be competent unless possessed of a mind capable of comprehending every possible source of revenue, for they extended to every possible means of raising money, whether by direct or indirect taxation. Under this clause may be imposed a poll tax, a tax on houses and buildings, on windows and fireplaces, on cattle, and all kinds of personal property. It extends to duties on all kinds of goods, to tonnage and poundage of vessels, to duties on written instruments, newspapers, almanacs, etc. It comprehends an excise on all kinds of liquor, spirits, wine, cider, beer, etc. Indeed, on every necessary or convenience of life, whether of foreign or homegrown or manufactured. In short, we have no conception of any way in which a government can raise money from the people but what is included in one of these general terms. Every source revenue is therefore committed to the hands of the general legislature. Now, let me just take a quick pause. Yes, these are very general terms. The federal government does have a broad way of trying to tax you or tax the states at this time. As a matter of fact, the taxation was really dependent upon goods coming in from foreign states. So in other words, the federal government really relied heavily upon imposts and duties instead of excises. Now, when Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, he actually tried to pass a law that would have allowed taxation on the sale of horses. What ended up happening was it was argued as unconstitutional because it was disparate or ununiform throughout the states. In other words, in the states that had heavy agriculture, they had lots of horses, and they would be paying more taxes instead of the northern manufacturing states like New England and New York. Therefore, it was considered ununiform in the application because here was an object that was more common in certain states and very rare in other states. So when you look at the fact is that all impost tax, if you read that preamble, they must be uniform in application. So in other words, there would be certain states and people that would be never affected by that because their life doesn't include lots of horses. And so it was proven that that was an unconstitutional levying of taxes because it wouldn't have been uniform throughout the different states. So here is one aspect of that preamble that this gentleman, Mr. Williams, is missing. He doesn't include some of these other constraints and some of these other enumerated powers that are very specific. More importantly, he relies upon the preambles as if they are granting general powers, but as Madison pointed out, they are strictly preambles. They are providing a tone for the foregoing section. The preamble of the Constitution sets a tone for the entire Constitution, and the preamble of Section 8 kind of creates the tone for why they're delegating these very specific powers, and then they list the very specific powers. So when we come back, I'll finish some of these comments from Mr. Williams, because I want you to see the anti-federalists and how they're kind of putting this on the table. But I am telling, well, I'm going to run out of time. We'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what I really want to get into, and the reason why I'm laying this out, this is the very last comment on Thursday, the 26th of June. And then the next day, Mr. Smith gets up, who's an anti-federalist, who talks about jurisdiction. And then Mr. Williams, the Honorable Mr. Williams, gets up again and he goes on. Mr. Chancellor, Mr. Livingston, okay, the Chancellor Livingston, he gets up and Mr. Chancellor, that's his first name's Chancellor. See, I'm really bad with names. Anyway, so Chancellor Livingston gets up and he starts talking about checks and balances as the refuting of the change in the argument. What I'm trying to tell you is here is a person articulating an argument against the Constitution that could create a perversion of what the Constitution is. Now, remember, I told you at the beginning of the show or earlier that the anti-federalist testimonies, such as Mr. Williams' testimony here, is stricken or thrown out. What would happen, the way I would do this for academic purposes, is if you took the ratification debates and created three different documents, the overall documents with both arguments, both sides, that would be the academic argument. The legal document would then be only the Federalist arguments and testimonies, throwing out or striking from the record all anti-federalist testimony. Now, that would be kind of tough because you have to understand that at a certain point in some of the processes, there some of the men actually turned and became federalist or supporting the Constitution instead of some of the wild accusations that they were making. Now, a great case in point would be Samuel Adams. Not like Samuel Adams actually made some wild, you know, hyperbolic comments regarding the Constitution, but he did change his opinion, and he pointed that out, that he too was very anxious, or he had his approbation regarding the Constitution, and now with His Excellency, or Mr. Hancock's suggestion of adding or providing recommended amendments, it got him on board. It changed his paradigm. So just to be clear, the anti-federalists everything that they're saying that is making an assumption or asserting that this is a bad thing, that this is granting general powers, doesn't make it true. What only thing that is actually legally binding and what the people accepted of the state was what the Federalists said. If the Federalists didn't say, yeah, these powers are going to be abused and this is how they're going to abuse it, you won't find that. It's not in the Federalist side of the testimony. Those are assertions that were rejected. So you just keep in mind that when we're looking at these documents, they're not just historical documents for academic purposes. They're legal documents. And that way, when you start going through what all of the Federalists said, you will find harmony. You will not find contention between general powers and enumerated powers. They all tell you that the powers are enumerated, that there are no general powers. Thus, there was no need for a Bill of Rights. Every single ratification debate went through that exact same process. Anyway, back to Mr. Williams. Not only these terms are very comprehensive and extend to a vast number of objects, but the power to lay and collect has great latitude. It will lead to the passing of vast numbers of laws, which may affect the personal rights of the citizens of the states and put their lives in jeopardy. Oh my gosh, we're gonna die. It will open a door to the appointment of a swarm of revenue and excise officers to prey upon the honest and industrious part of the community. Now, that's hyperbole. Who are the tax collectors based on the Constitution? It's really clear. Right there within the Constitution, it says that the Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. The first time they had to do tax collection was through the militia when they had the Whiskey Rebellion. People weren't willing to pay the taxes. The states, other than that, were more than willing to pay the taxes. Therefore, I am trying to help you understand that when these men are making these comments, even though there may not have been a rebuttal, it doesn't make their comment more legal or more valid. They were rejected completely by the ratification of the Constitution. Here's his closing comments, or what I'm going to end up on. Let us inquire also what is implied in the authority to pass all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry this power into execution. It is perhaps utterly impossible fully to define this power. The authority granted in the first clause can only be understood in its full extent by descending to all particular cases in which revenue can be raised. Absolutely not. Absolutely, because it must be uniform. That's the first thing he already forgot. And there was already that limitation in that same clause. So why is it that he ignored using or pointing to the uniformity clause in that clause? You think I'm kidding here, but actually I will point, because here is section 8, and it says this, that here is the preamble. To lay and collect taxes, imposts, and excises. You can tell I'm turning my head. Let me actually bring this over this way. Okay. To lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense, general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, see, this is all a part of the preamble, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Why did he leave that off? Because it didn't fit his nasty, evil narrative of how bad this is going to be. Anyway, and you know, back in those days, there was a lot of apprehension in calling somebody out for using hyperbole and or, you know, making unfounded assertions and so forth, because in these days, you impugn somebody's character, you impugn their honor, you would be walking paces right outside that building in a duel. That's because these men had the right to defend their honor, and there was almost a duel between Corbin and Patrick Henry in the Virginia ratification debate. Most people thought for sure, because Corbin was a young man. I mean, he was a very young man and very let's say green behind the ears. I mean, he was just cutting his teeth. And he thought the world of Madison. And so he went toe-to-toe with Patrick Henry and literally did insult him to where everybody just goes, and they kind of just, you know, they look at Patrick Henry, and then Patrick Henry goes into this dramatic state, you know, of basically bowing to this mighty master Corbin. And he diffuses it that way. But I don't think Patrick Henry relied much on his sidearm as much as his wit. However, had things been different, and that would have been Alexander Hamilton and Corbin, Hamilton would have taken him out and done a duel, because Hamilton, actually, I believe it was Hamilton that almost had a duel with James Monroe, and it was Aaron Burr who actually diffused the situation. And ironically, later on, it was Hamilton that died by a duel from Aaron Burr, who didn't care to diffuse the situation and was tired of Hamilton, so much so, because if you understand the duel, and I'm going into history you probably don't care about, but at the duel, Hamilton threw his shot. He actually won the opportunity to take the first shot. He was a good marksman. He was a military-trained man. This guy was good. And so he threw his shot deliberately over the head of Mr. Corbin, and then thought that Mr. Corbin would give him the same respect. Not Corbin, Aaron Burr. And Aaron Burr had no respect for him at this point in time. And as a matter of fact, took his aim, shot him. He got in his boat, Hamilton got in his boat, and Hamilton went across the river, and 6 hours or something like that later died in the arms of his wife. Anyway, so you have to understand that, you know, these weren't drive-by shooting days. These were days of honor and integrity where, you know, you don't just get away with slapping somebody in the face or dishonoring them. They had a right to defend their honor. Anyway. The number and variety, back to Mr. Williams' final comments or closing up his comments, the number and variety of these cases are so endless that no man hath yet been able to reckon upon them. The greatest geniuses of the world have been for ages employed in the research, and when mankind had supposed the subject was exhausted, they have been astonished for the redefined improvements that have made in modern times, and especially in the English nation, on the subject of taxation. I'm adding that, of taxation. If, then, the objects of this power cannot be comprehended, how is it possible to understand the extent of that power which can pass all laws that may be necessary and proper for carrying into execution? A case cannot be conceived which is not included in this power. It is well known that the subject of the revenue is the most difficult and extensive in the science of government. It requires the greatest talents of a statesman and the most numerous and exact provisions of a legislature. And so, wow, perfect timing. Wow, I couldn't have timed that better. When we come back in our next episode, I will give you a couple more examples of Hamilton, because actually we're going to be getting into Mr. Smith, an anti-federalist, and like I said, Mr. Livingston on checks and balances and how they start changing the argument. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.